please rise? The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Connolly, Judge Glory, the Honorable Louise DeRay Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. And welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Thursday, February 7th. I am glad to see people made it here safe and sound, not without some slipping and sliding on the road, I'm sure. The first matter on the calendar is the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce versus City of Minneapolis. I know, Council, you are all familiar with our rules. You'll each have 15 minutes for your argument. Council for Appellant will have 5 minutes in addition for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. So with that, Council, well, and you know about the lighting and all that stuff at the podium. And the podium can be raised or lowered to meet your needs. With that, Council for Appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Your Honor, this is the second time this matter is before this court. Previously, this case was up on review of the district court's partial grant of a temporary injunction, and the standard of review was, I forgot to identify myself per the court's direction. I will start over. May it please the court, my name is Sarah McLaren, and I represent Appellant City of Minneapolis. This case was previously before this court on review of the district court's ruling on respondent's motion for a temporary injunction. That standard of review was abuse of discretion. Now this case is in front of this court on review of the district court's ruling on a permanent injunction. So this is this court's first opportunity to apply a de novo standard of review to this matter. The city believes that its case has only gotten stronger since this case was previously before the court, and my intent this morning is to first address the extraterritoriality matter and then also address the conflict preemption and field preemption issues raised by respondent Minnesota Chamber of Commerce et al. With regards to extraterritoriality, respondent is asking this court for the first time to limit a municipality's ability to police conduct within its borders affecting public health based on extraterritorial impact that policing such conduct would have. There is over 100 years of precedent.
Ms. McLaren, getting right to that point, could the city of Minneapolis pass a similar ordinance guaranteeing sick leave for someone who only worked 1 hour in the city?
I think that question would be, I don't think the determining factor is the threshold.
What if it was 1 minute?
I think the determining factor is it would go into a due process analysis. So I definitely think that there are employers over which the city of Minneapolis could not assert jurisdiction. If someone's employee just accidentally wandered into the city or just did a very quick...
And I'm not even going with the amicus brief where, you know, there are all these chamber of horrors, you know, no pun intended, about, you know, walking through and coming in here and doing a document production. I'm just saying an employee who otherwise doesn't have, you know, based in Richfield, has an employee who does work in Minneapolis 1 hour a year. Could the city impose the similar sort of regime of sick leave on that employer?
I think the answer to that question would be yes. And the analysis I would apply to that question would be twofold. First, I would look at whether I do think, as I said before, there would be a due process analysis that would need to take place, whether there were enough contacts between the city of Minneapolis and that employer. And so assuming there was a purposeful direction of that employee.
Well, let's assume it's the same context that the respondent is saying the employers have with Minneapolis now for 80 hours. So it's the exact same thing. They have a person working 1 hour in Minneapolis a year. So
Certainly. So the case I think is most instructive to this court, and unfortunately it seems to be one of the only cases that has been addressed on this issue in the last 100 years is the Nelson case. And if you look at that case, there was no threshold.
Right.
If there was...
But there it was, you're selling... If you sell any milk at all, the city has a right to check it because presumably any ounce of bad milk could cause harm. So my question is, as I understand it, the purpose and what the district court was concerned about was, well, under this regime of the necessary to, prevent sickness, and, we don't want people coming into Minneapolis sick, and I understand there were other reasons for the ordinance, but a lot of it was, well, we don't want people getting sick. The district court seemed to focus on, well, at the end of the day, if it's only at a minimum 80 hours a year and you only get sort of a sliding scale sick leave, is that really reasonably related to keeping people healthy? And at least that's what I understood to be the district court's argument. And so, and we can all debate on what that number should be, but I guess if 80 hours is not a problem under this reasonably related, then 1 hour shouldn't be a problem, right? Because, theoretically, if you're here 1 hour, you could, I could cough on respondent's lawyer right now and make him sick. But is that reasonably related? And that's where I have the extraterritorial argument concerns that the district court did, and at least we did, in affirming the injunction under a different standard of review.
Certainly. So what I'd like to address is that standard in Nelson, because I think that is the focus. And I think the district court misread Nelson because it looked to certain language in Nelson which said the ordinance in Nelson only went as far as was reasonably necessary to assure the outcome. But if you look later in the case, the district court, there was a challenge to the ordinance in Nelson on the fact that there was evidence in the record that the test was unreliable and could be deleterious to the health of the cows to which it was administered. And the district court didn't get into that in that case, and it said what it looked to instead was whether the ordinance had a reasonable tendency to prevent the harm, there the sale of unwholesome milk. And here there is ample record evidence of the positive health impacts of paid sick and safe time. And so the ordinance easily passes that test set forth in
Nelson.
But
if it's a reasonable tendency, I guess the question the district court had, and which I share, is, twofold. One is, if you're only working 2 weeks a year, you're not likely to get people sick because, 2 weeks out of 52 is 2 weeks. And then even more important, the limited sick time you would get for those 80 hours a week is not enough to keep you, not coming in. I mean, it'd be one thing it said, anybody who's sick doesn't come in. That's clear that, well, if you're sick, you're not coming in and you can't infect people. But my concern is how do we get to 80 hours versus 1 hour to achieve the goal, which is public health in the city of Minneapolis?
I think those questions go along the line of what I think of in my mind is its goodness of fit of the proposed solution to the proposed problem. And that is where I think the language in Nelson is so instructive, because the court did not require a perfect fit in that case. And in fact, there was evidence it was far from a perfect fit. That those are legislative questions with certain constitutional boundaries around them as far as due process go. But I think the lesson from Nelson is that this court is not tasked with making sure that Minneapolis has found a perfect way to prevent the spread of disease within its borders, but acting as a community health board and as a home rule charter city, it has found a way that has a reasonable tendency to promote the goal here. And it has not gone with the 1 hour. We might be having a different conversation if we were, strongly sticking to that 1 hour
or
threshold.
You might be arguing a different point of law. When I read Nelson, and I've read it many times because, as you say, there's very little case law on this old doctrine of extraterritoriality. But what it seems that the Nelson court came down to is the fact that there was no extraterritorial operation because the only subject upon which that ordinance operated was the sale of milk within the city. What is the subject on which this Minneapolis ordinance operates?
The subject on which this Minneapolis ordinance operates in terms of extraterritoriality would be the prevention of people working while sick in Minneapolis due to lack of access to paid sick leave.
And so how does the record keeping requirements, which seem to be one of the areas of focus of the chamber, how are those provisions reasonably necessary to prevent sick people from working in Minneapolis?
Well, Your Honor, I would say, first of all, briefly, we've put forth in our briefing, we think the burden is greatly overstated by respondents, and discovery did show that. However,
some burden.
Well, I mean, of course it...
I mean, you know, it's different to make United Healthcare do this because they've got to fill out forms for everything versus Joe Blow and Sons, you know, where, you know, every dime is every dime.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I mean, obviously, any additional legislation imposes some impact on business. I'm not disputing that there is some additional work that must
be. How does this record keeping, as Judge Bjorkman so ably pointed out, encourage health, public health?
It ensures that the employees have access to the paid sick leave which they have otherwise earned under the ordinance. Because without, in the absence of any record keeping, I mean, it would almost be an honor system, I guess, where an employee would have to say, no, I really have worked those hours in this city. Trust me, boss. And obviously, that would not make sense.
And presumably, then there's a penalty if you don't keep the records, or if you violate, then, you know, not giving someone sick leave for 80 hours or, you know, whatever the magic numbers are, 80 hours, and then you prorate a sick leave for that.
Yes, there's an enforcement scheme built into the ordinance. I would say when you look at the extra...
Is there an enforcement scheme in Nelson?
Yes, there were criminal penalties, Your Honor. And what I was going to say, and then I would like to briefly address the other two points raised by respondent, but what I would like to say is when you look at the extraterritorial activities required by Nelson, they were far greater than those of the record-keeping here. In Nelson, you had city veterinarians traveling outside the city to administer tests, tag the livestock, remove diseased animals from the herd, and then there were criminal penalties for violation.
But those were actions of city employees going out and doing that inspection. I mean, here we have the financial record keeping and other burdens on employers that don't do business regularly or aren't residents of Minneapolis. I mean, that is a distinction, isn't it?
Well, perhaps, although I would say I'm sure that the those subject to the ordinance in Nelson felt that some stranger coming onto their property and removing their livestock from the herd was also burdensome. I would also say that these employers, like the milk producers in Nelson, are purposely choosing to send their employees into Minneapolis. There is a decision on that level. And as the court said in Nelson, you can avoid the impacts of the ordinance by choosing not to sell milk in the city of Minneapolis. Similarly here, employers can choose not to have their employees go into Minneapolis for work purposes. I see my time is expiring. I don't want to cut off this conversation. Were there any other questions on extraterritoriality at this point, or shall I turn to...
I have a question with respect to one of your other issues, and that is the issue of preemption. I mean, there is a plethora of Minnesota statutes that deal with leave issues of various kinds, everything from sick leave to bone marrow donation, attendance of military ceremonies. I mean, why doesn't it just the breadth of the legislation suggests that our legislature has intended to preempt the field of employer-provided leave?
Your Honor, that is a question that we have recently received guidance from the Supreme Court in the Jennison decision. And there, the challengers in that case, which I believe it was the city in that case because it was a charter amendment, they said that the existence of a framework in state legislation is itself evidence of field preemption, of the legislative intent to preempt local legislation on a certain issue. Here, I would argue we have far less of a comprehensive framework than that which existed in Jennison. And every indication in the legislation is to add rights for employees and to not prevent employers from providing additional rights. So there is no evidence of legislative intent to curtail the ability of local governments to add rights for employees, which is
The statutes, a couple of them say we're not intending to dissuade employers from providing additional leave, but I don't know how that equates to we're not trying, to your statement that we're not trying to dissuade local municipalities from enacting stronger or different leave policies.
Certainly. So to a certain extent, I think we're trying to read the intent from legislative silence on an issue because the state legislature has not affirmatively stated one way or the other whether there should be local legislation on this. However, we have cited numerous cases in our briefing in which legislative silence was not enough to show either a conflict or field preemption. In the cases where the courts find that the legislature has intended not to permit local legislation, there is some indication, affirmative indication from the legislature, that there should be a uniform policy or that there should not be local legislation on the issue. I see my time has expired. With the court's permission, I'll briefly address conflict on rebuttal since we did not get to that issue.
All right, thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Chris Laris on behalf of respondents, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, Minnesota Recruiting and Staffing Association, Twin West Chamber of Commerce, Graco, and Adagawa Anshel General Contractors. Three separate times the city's ordinance has been subject to judicial review of some type, and each of those times the reviewing court affirmed an injunction that prohibited the extraterritorial application of the significant burdens imposed by the statute, the ordinance at issue. First, in granting the temporary injunction, Judge Dickstein properly concluded that the ordinance exceeded the city's territorial authority and enjoined the city from enforcing it against business employers outside the geographic bounds of the city, and that was affirmed.
And that was before the 2018 amendments, which specified that the required leave only applied to work that the employee was going to otherwise be required to do in the city of Minneapolis.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's a pretty significant amendment, isn't it, in terms of our evaluation of whether the subject of the ordinance operates, you know, in Minneapolis or outside of Minneapolis's jurisdiction, isn't it?
With all due respect, we don't believe it's significant at all, and neither did Judge Dickstein, and that's the case for two reasons. First of all, that amendment expressly, and the amendment documents that are in front of the court expressly provided that didn't change the substantive ordinance at all. That's what it said. What it claimed in the amendment document was that it merely provided some clarity that had already existed.
Well, I think the clarity was that the city was not enforcing it in a different way, but this said, hey, it's only an employment in the city for which paid leave must be provided.
I would simply, just to clarify the point, Your Honor, I would simply cite, Your Honor, to the city's addendum at page 22, which does contain a statement by the city relating to this amendment, clarifying that it is not changing the terms of the pre-existing ordinance.
So you're saying we should ignore the terms of the amendment because of that preliminary statement?
I view that as just kind of hedging your bets. You know, it is different, but not really. And in any event, don't hold it against us.
Well, so I guess two things. First of all, the city's own language, I think, clarifies why it's not significant. But let me address another point that I think goes to the heart of why Judge Dickstein found it was not significant, and that's that the amendment did not alter the record-keeping obligations set forth in 40.270 of the city's ordinance. And those were the record keep.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll let you finish your answer. I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, my question is, what record evidence would you point us to that would support your argument that this is a burdensome, that this ordinance is so burdensome on your clients or our business owners outside of the city of Minneapolis? Because I read somewhere in one of the briefs that the parties attempted to discover that issue during the course of the litigation here, and discovery was restricted on actual what the burdens were that your clients were suffering.
And I will just say I share Judge Flory's concerns.
Very good. So I'm happy to have the opportunity to address that. So under the test implied by Nelson, the Judge Dickstein went through the balancing that was absolutely necessary to determine whether or not this ordinance's extraterritorial impact went only so far as was reasonably necessary. And in doing that balancing, he recognized on the one hand that the city had failed to articulate any basis for the 80-hour threshold.
But and we're looking at this de novo now. So what Judge Dickstein relied upon, you know, might be helpful guidance to us. But my question is, what evidence in the record is there that supports your claim that this is an excessive burden on the folks that you're representing here today?
Sure. So with respect to the burden, and again, in the face of no evidence from the city about the support that the tie to this 80-hour threshold with its goal, on the other hand, there was substantial record evidence. So first of all, Judge Dickstein, in his opinion, went through on the facial read of the ordinance, the obligations that were imposed on all employers who met this minimum threshold. So that was one thing. Second thing, there was actually record evidence submitted by my clients in the form of deposition testimony about that burden. And I'll identify two particular things that we thought were very impactful. With respect to Plaintiff Twin West Chamber, which is itself not only an association, but a business that is based in Plymouth, there was undisputed testimony that employer hires certain employees who do not receive paid sick leave benefits, but they, quote, oftentimes, end quote, attend meetings in the city. And I would cite to respondents addendum at 20, the McMillan deposition at 145 to 146. Twin West also testified that it doesn't track the location, didn't have a system to track when a given employee leaves its Plymouth offices to attend a meeting for an hour and a half.
I thought the appellants in some portion of the ordinance kind of dealt with that problem. Am I incorrect? This sort of transitory, you know, I'm just coming in for a meeting. I thought there was sort of something about in a different sort of the ordinance, and I could be wrong, that sort of said, no, we're not going to get you there. And I recall that you had an argument, well, you know, that's what they say, but who knows what they're going to do. But, I mean, are we really going to... I would be surprised if somebody who's just driving in for a meeting, you know, they're going to go after that person. But, you know, I could be wrong.
Are they going to go after... Well, Your Honor, what we have is an ordinance that places specific facial obligations on employers.
Well, let me ask you this.
With an enforcement mechanism...
Do you agree that, you know, the city can be validly concerned with promoting the public health of its citizens?
Yes.
Okay. Do you think the city could pass an ordinance that said, no matter where you are, if you have an employee who comes into Minneapolis, you have to provide proof that they got a flu shot? And it's so serious that we're going to make sure that it's an employer-provided, paid flu shot. Do you think the city could do that?
You know, with all due respect, I have not considered that. But I think the Nelson test would clearly provide the framework.
Let's say, for the sake of argument, I think the city could do that. What's the difference between that and, you know, the sick, you know, this sort of 80 hours and, you know, I don't know what the math is. I'm not good at that. But, you know, you're going to wind up with 2 hours of sick leave that time.
An hour and a half a week and one day over 4 years. Though that's the math.
I would respond to that by saying, you know, flu shots don't work. You know, at least they didn't work for me this year. But you know what?
an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. For that one chance, it's going to work, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you have to keep the records of it if we want to look at it.
Understood. I was simply trying to point out the math of what I think are the two most operative points, and that the threshold is as little as an hour and a half a week, and that the benefit received by the employee
What if it was, instead of 80 hours, which is 2 weeks, what if the city ordinance said, for any employees who work 40 weeks a year in Minneapolis, do you think that would be a valid ordinance? Under the same framework of they get the sick leave under this sliding scale.
Well, I think actually what would be required is an assessment under the Nelson test about the nexus and the reasonable necessity.
The more you work in the city, the more likely you're going to get sick, the more you should have sick leave.
That would certainly be one of the arguments as part of that reasonable necessity. What Nelson says is that although cities have broad powers generally, when they are applying those powers in a way that has an impact outside of its territorial limits, the test for is whether that's permissible is whether the ordinance goes only so far as is necessary to meet the goal.
So is the problem, and here I'm just going to give a shout out to Ms. Wick's excellent deposition where she, I don't know who it was from the city, so how'd you come up with the 80 hours? And it was like, not so sure. What if the evidence is, you know, I've got this Harvard Health study, and it says the tipping point is 2 weeks. You know, believe it or not, that's where, you know, the cost-benefit analysis is. So 80 hours, not less than that, it won't make a difference, but 80 hours in terms of spreading germs, that's the number. What if they had that study? Wouldn't that show it's reasonably related to the goals of promoting public health in the city of Minneapolis?
Your Honor, first of all, we would say the test is not reasonable relation. It's interesting, the city has argued at first that Judge Dickstein erred by somehow importing themes about due process, and then they turn around and argue that it's actually a due process standard itself. It's not. The test under Nelson is whether the ordinance goes only so far as is reasonably necessary.
That's one of the things Nelson said. It seems to me what the Nelson decision read as a whole asks is whether the subject of the ordinance operates within the city. And so in this case, does the sick and safe leave ordinance operate on conduct outside the city of Minneapolis?
It undisputedly does.
And what is the conduct it operates on that takes place outside the city?
The conduct that it operates on is the record-keeping conduct that is mandated under the statute. Under the ordinance.
And in this day and age where I would assume that most employment records, when you clock in, when you clock out, are kept electronically. How burdensome is it to have an extra box that says, did you work in Minneapolis for any of these hours? I mean, I'm struggling with figuring out whether that is a burden that goes beyond what is reasonably necessary to accomplish the goals of the ordinance.
The record evidence is that it is quite burdensome. I cited Your Honors to the testimony of Twin West Chambers with specific page sites about the fact that it would require entirely new systems. The second I would point out is we had testimony from the Minnesota Staffing and Recruiting Association.
And how are those restrictions any more burdensome than the cattle inspection and litany of things that the city of Minneapolis inspectors were able to do with cattle that were far flung from Minneapolis?
Sure. So under Nelson, which says is the test, is the extraterritorial application only only go as far as is reasonably necessary, there's a balancing. So in some ways, those were burdensome. But they were burdensome in this balancing in the face of some very specific underlying facts in Nelson. So while it's de novo, there are factual underpinnings. And in Nelson, the Supreme Court referred to, quote, proof in the case that the wholesomeness of milk could not be tested in any other way. That the goal of the ordinance,
keep sick people from working in Minneapolis if you didn't apply it to all employees that come to Minneapolis to work sick?
But that's not what they're doing. You could have, perhaps
well, that's
you
what
could,
the 2018 amendments say. They say, I mean, if you're only going to require employers to pay for sick leave for time that the employee was scheduled to work in the city of Minneapolis.
Paid sick leave. If you want, if your honor's question was, what could the city do to stop people from working sick in the city? City could pass an ordinance that you shall not work sick in the city. And if you're found working sick in the city, you're subject to some kind of sanction. And I'm not suggesting it, but that's certainly possible.
But what then the wouldn't that have even more of an impact on employers? All of a sudden, they couldn't get their work done in Minneapolis at all.
All of this, Your Honor, comes to a balancing mandated by Nelson.
And I guess my question is, what is to be balanced? The underlying policy decisions? That strikes me that's not what we're balancing.
No.
But it is the occasion and subject of the ordinance and whether it operates in Minneapolis or outside of Minneapolis.
It's what is required to be balanced when assessing does the ordinance go only so far as is necessary is the extraterritorial impact on one hand and the impact on the ordinance's underlying goals. That's why in Nelson, there was an expressed factual finding that this ordinance, there was no other alternative. In fact, there was express finding in reference to proof in the case they couldn't just test the milk and that it would be very inadequate, quote, very inadequate to the goals behind the ordinance if you didn't have this testing regime. In contrast here, when looking at the factual underpinnings of your de novo review, we have a complete imbalance. We have absolutely no evidence that ties the 80-hour threshold to the goals of the ordinance. And to Judge Connolly's question, this wasn't simply an artful deposition by Ms. Wick. This was and she certainly did a great job, but this was a central part of the argument in front of Judge Dickstein. And Judge Dickstein repeatedly invited counsel for the city to articulate some basis that ties that threshold to their goal. And there was none. There is no evidentiary basis at all that the city could identify other than, hey, this looked good and we lifted it from some other ordinance.
So you're saying that 80-hour threshold is unreasonable. Are you saying that the part of the amendment that says the paid sick leave only applies to work that was scheduled to be performed in Minneapolis, you're not claiming that part is unreasonable, are you? It's the 80-hour threshold that's the primary argument?
The imposition of extraterritorial burdens on employers where there is only de minimis contact with the city. In this case, there is no balance. The ordinance clearly does not go only so far as is necessary. And I'd like to follow up, if I could.
Can I ask you a question? Okay. I want to ask you about the preemption issue, too.
Okay. And certainly one thing I did want to clarify, because the city faulted Judge Dickstein for focusing on this only so far as is necessary, reasonably necessary language. We absolutely believe that's the test. It is true that in another part of the Nelson decision, after addressing the question of extraterritoriality based on the only so far as reasonably necessary test, the court also addressed a second issue, and the court did us a favor by clearly identifying as it number two, and that was a different objection that the ordinance was oppressive and unreasonable. And it was in connection with that different challenge that the ordinance was oppressive and unreasonable, not that it was extraterritorial, but that it was oppressive and reasonable that we had this other test that it that there was a reasonable tendency to meet
okay.
the goal.
I want to ask you just in concluding, do you contend that the ordinance permits, authorizes, or encourages violation of any of the statutes that you have brought to the court's attention?
It does not, no, it doesn't, and what would simply say is that we don't believe that that is the appropriate test for determining whether there's a conflict. The question is not whether you can have whether you can avoid violating a state statute. Rather, Mangold sets forth a number of specific tests for whether or not there's a conflict.
Well, okay.
And I know this is a big
issue. It identifies principles to guide courts in deciding whether they're irreconcilable, but I will rely on your brief for that. Does anyone?
I do have. I know we're way over time here, but and just in looking at the injunction, the permanent injunction, it seems vague to me. And my concern is it permanently enjoins enforcing the ordinance against employers resident outside the geographic boundaries. What does that mean? It's not defined in the order. Does that mean corporate office? Does that mean place of business? Does that mean so many employees work? I mean, it seems like the permanent injunction is too vague to be supported. What's your response to that?
So, Your Honor, our response is we disagree, and we would raise two primary points on this. First of all, the concept of residency is something that that is found in numerous other Minnesota statutes, and it is well recognized in the law. The complete boundaries and confines of that can be worked out, but residency is not something that is a novel concept. Secondly, I'd point out that any challenge that the city is trying to bring into this appeal has clearly been waived. After this court affirmed the language of the preliminary injunction, even through the summary judgment and even following the summary judgment, the city never sought clarification. The city never went to went to Judge Dickstein with alternative language and sought that clarification. And we would simply cite.
Why would they? They think he's wrong.
They think
it
he's
shouldn't
wrong.
Apply at all. They don't care. For their position is it doesn't matter whether you're a resident, a non-resident, principal place or not. If you've got people working 80 hours in the city, you're under the ordinance.
I understand that's your position, Your Honor. I would simply point out that under the precedent of numerous cases, including State v. Wang, matters that are not argued or considered in the district court are waived. And in connection with this, with the party's motion for summary judgment, after considering 1,000 pages of evidence, that was not something that they sought to challenge, and therefore we believe that it was clear waiver and that should not be raised now. They could have gone to Judge Dickstein after receiving, or as an alternative, Judge Connolly. They could have certainly gone back and said, we think you're wrong, but with all due respect, at least clarify this, and they did not.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. McLaren, you will have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd briefly like to respond to a couple points raised by Respondents' Counsel. First, I do want to clarify that an area of the record that's not in the addendum but maybe of interest since it was briefly discussed to the court is the rules implementing the ordinance. I apologize for not including that in the addendum, but it is document index number 111. And so it is in the record, and those rules set forth the situations such as the pass-through employee, someone just driving through, no work stops related, that time spent doing that activity will not
be counted. Well, I was kind of right. I did see something about that. Thank God.
That it has been the city's position and it pursuant to the rules and will continue to be. Also, the evidence of burden on the employers, we believe, was incompletely stated both in the briefing by respondents and at oral argument in that the Twin West employer, they do not currently have any employees that would meet that definition of needing additional sick time. That was the, they converted their PTO to cover the time under the ordinance. And there had been in the past employees that might have required additional time, but they didn't currently have any. Didn't have any date to hire any. And the MNRISA Business Association that he also referenced, that must have been testimony about their business members on whom we were not allowed to do discovery because MNRISA has no employees. So they will not themselves be subject to the ordinance. With regards to, I didn't previously address conflict, so I can address that very briefly. And answer any questions the court may have on any topic.
Doesn't the ordinance appear on its face to prohibit conduct that is either expressly or impliedly permitted by the statutes, i.e. of the statutes cited to us, I think only two of them require any kind of paid leave, with the inference being, you know, the employer shouldn't have to pay leave. They need to provide it, but it's expressly stated as unpaid leave in all the other statutes. I mean, doesn't that suggest that this ordinance, in fact, it conflicts with the implication, at the very least, of the statutes?
I think that, conflict, when you look at how it's interpreted in the case law, it has never been previously interpreted to state that if state law sets this type of required, this level of required conduct, and the ordinance requires more, unless there's some sort of express statement in the state law saying that you are expressly permitted to do no more than this, and there has never been found to be a conflict then with a municipal regulation that sets a higher floor, in essence. So this goes back to, I believe the district court referred to it as a floor and a ceiling. Is the state statute a ceiling on what can be required of employers, or a floor? And we believe when you look at the case law, which we've cited a number of cases in our briefing, Minnesota courts have routinely found that there is no conflict between local regulations and state law, even if state law implicitly permits the conduct prohibited by the local regulation. And that is in the Canadian Connection case, State v. Daly, and the GEM case.
Although State versus Daly, as I recall, hasn't been cited for a very long time.
It is, unfortunately, it's more recent than our State v. Nelson case, but I agree, it has been.
That doesn't say much, does it?
But as such is the state of the law. So that would be our response to that on the conflict issue, and unless the court has any other questions.
Yes, I did.
Yes.
You know, Ms. McLaren, is your strongest argument on the extraterritorial issue the one that Judge Bjorkman focused on, which is this is a subject, you know, this is an ordinance, the subject of this ordinance is what is in Minneapolis. I mean, you know, that's my poor language, not hers. Is that what we should be focusing on for extraterritoriality? Is that there are employees working X number of hours in Minneapolis, and this is designed to regulate the conduct of those employers?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say if you look at State v. Nelson and contrast it with Duluth v. Orr, that is the key distinction that is drawn in the limited authority we have on this issue. Where in Duluth v. Orr, there was no conduct occurring within the city limits. Duluth just wanted to basically build a one-mile buffer around its city limits within which no dynamite could be stored. So there was nothing within the city limits here. Here we have employers purposefully sending their employees in to do work in the city of Minneapolis. That is the key distinction, and we believe that is why this ordinance passes
and
muster.
And that's because, and then I'll end, I mean, in the entire record, I didn't see any connection between 80 hours and, you know, that's what keeps people, that's the tipping point between in healthy and unhealthy. I mean, I didn't see how you came up with 80 hours, and maybe that's not important, but I didn't see any record evidence to support. Yep, and we've all decided that it's 80 hours as opposed to 40 versus 180 versus 50 weeks a year.
Certainly, and unfortunately, we do have a lot of public health record evidence in the record, but unfortunately, public health doesn't work that way, where one certain hour threshold is going to suddenly provide greater public health benefits. In Nelson, the threshold was zero as a courtesy to employers and as a recognition that other cities have had that perhaps the burdens are too high when you go to the threshold that public health truly would demand to fully address this public health issue. The city, like other cities, has gone with 80 hours, but that should not be held against it in this analysis. Thank you.
All right, thank you both for your helpful arguments. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision. Statutory 90-day period.